And continue in our study then. We're in 2 Kings chapter 3. Excuse me. I feel the throat tightening up a little bit. I have water. I don't think it's water. I think something else is going on there. But we left the armies of Israel, Judah, and Edom last week. Coalition of these three armies had gathered together to go in and fight against Moab. What has occasioned all of this is that Moab, for many, many years, had been a vassal state to the northern kingdom of Israel. But when Ahab died, Moab rebelled. They stopped sending the tribute of 100,000 sheep and the wool of 100,000 rams every year. And so after a couple of years, Jehoash, the son of Ahab, decides it is time to reclaim that prerogative. So he convinces Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, to join him in an expedition to Moab. They decide which way to go by not going the quick route along the north of the Dead Sea and south then into Moab over here. If I scroll up a little bit, everything north of this line is the nation of Israel. This area down here is the nation of Judah. The kingdoms have been split now for about 150 years. Yeah, but they're going to join together on this occasion because why, let me ask you this, I'll quiz you. Why does Jehoshaphat want to help out Jehoram or Jehoaz, the king of the northern kingdom? Why does he feel so compelled to help him? He was friends with Ahab, yep. And even more so, what else did he do to join his kingdom to the kingdom of Ahab? He took Ahab's daughter for his son, right? So you have Jehoshaphat took Ahab's daughter and married her to Jehoshaphat's son. So the kingdoms are now united by marriage. And as we looked at, this actually winds up being a very bad thing for Judah. In the book of Matthew, three generations of the kings of Judah are gone from the king lists. It happens to be the three generations that follow this marriage. And God, I think, is testifying that that relationship was an ungodly one. They were so given to idolatry because of Ahab and Jezebel that God, in a disciplinary way, removed their names from the king lists in the book of Matthew. Well, at any rate, they are allied right now. The nation of Israel summoned its troops here, and they came down to Jerusalem here. And instead of going across the northern tip of the Dead Sea and going southward into Moab, they decided to take the long way around. They headed down here through the wilderness, crossed over at the southern part of the Dead Sea, picked up the king of Edom and his army, and proceeded to ascend probably this valley here. There would have been a little river called a wadi flowing down through this. Except what's going on at this point in time of the year? I should say what's not going on. There's no rain. Yeah, there hasn't been any rain and the armies are in trouble. They have no water for their troops or for their animals. So here they are on the eve of a major battle and all their troops are drying up. That's not a good place to be. Well, Jehoshaphat says, hey, let's try to find a prophet of the Lord to inquire of. What does God want us to do? And so Elisha happens to be in the army, and he gives them some instruction. And what's his instruction? Did we get to that part last week? Maybe I forgot. I forget if that was our part last week or not. Yeah, God said, just wait. In the morning, I'm going to fill this place up with water. And not only that, I'm going to deliver Moab into your hand. And when you get into the land of Moab, I want you to cut down every good tree, and I want you to throw rocks in all the fields. We're going to make Moab uninhabitable. And what's the word? Uninhabitable for the next generation or so. That's the instruction that they get from the Lord through Elijah. Elisha. So, verse 20 of 2 Kings chapter 3 is where we'll pick up. The next morning, about the time of offering the sacrifice, behold, water came from the direction of Edom till the country was filled with water. So here they are in this little river valley that descends down into the Dead Sea Basin. And God sends water from somehow, whether he sent a big rainstorm that nobody saw where they were at, or whether he just made the water flow out of the ground. It doesn't tell us which one of those. But they're in this wadi, and all of a sudden it fills up with water right about the time of the morning sacrifice, which would have been about 6 o'clock in the morning. And so here they are. They have plenty of water now to feed their, or to not to feed, but to drink their animals and for they themselves to drink. And that immediate problem is solved. But God does something else through this miracle as well. And that starts in verse 21 because he gave two parts to the promise. I'm going to give you water. And if that were a small thing, I'm also going to deliver Moab into your hand. So here's how God's going to accomplish the victory against Moab. Verse 21, when all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to put on armor from the youngest to the oldest were called out and were drawn up at the border. The border of Moab is this little wadi here. So probably you're looking at this, all these troops of Moab standing up here on the top of this river valley waiting for the kings of Israel. They know they're coming, but who do they have to conscript into the army? Everybody. Why do you think they have to get the youngest to the oldest? I mean, usually you don't conscript your youngest men because they're not full strength yet, and you don't conscript your oldest men because they're past their strength. Their army's weak. And yeah, they were under submission to Israel, but there's another reason. If you go to the book of 1 Chronicles, chapters 20, 21, 22, you'll read about the reign of Jehoshaphat. And it comes about during Jehoshaphat's reign, before this event happened, that Moab and Edom conspired together to rebel against Israel. And they took a massive army around the south end of the Dead Sea, and they got up here as far as En-Gedi, which is this region on the northwestern side of the Dead Sea. They were in the region of En-Gedi, which is only a couple of days' march from Jerusalem. So we're talking about an imminent threat. Jehoshaphat gathers all the armies of Israel into the temple, and he prays to God and asks for God's help. And God says, you know what? You're not even going to have to lift a finger, and I'm going to defeat this army for you. And what happens is, in the morning, the king of Edom and the king of Moab, their armies turn on each other. God just instills a sense of fear and I had another word, and it's gone. Panic, that was the word. Fear and panic. See, it comes. It just comes slowly. I can feel the neurons working their way up, and then they connect. Bing, 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 there it is, right? Instills a sense of panic in them, and these two armies begin fighting each other, and they slaughter each other. And when Judah, the king Jehoshaphat, and the armies of Judah get there, everybody's dead. So God defeated that coalition, and it only happened maybe 3 or 4 years before this point. So why is the army of Moab forced to conscript young men and old men? Because God wiped out their army just a few years ago. They don't have much left. And so here they all are drawn up in this last desperate attempt to defend their kingdom from this invasion. And they have to conscript all the young boys, and they've got to conscript the older men, and anybody that could even put armor on. So we're talking down to very, very young people, probably into the early teens. They've got these boys strapping on armor as much as they can. Imagine how terrifying that would be, Tim. Have to strap on that armor and hold a sword and defend your country. Be tough, wouldn't it? So, this is where they're at. But they come to this region of land, whether it's down in the valley or right at the top of it, you know, we're not sure, but whatever it is, they look across the landscape and it's all filled up with water. Except they don't think it's water. What do they think it is? Look at verse 23. Sorry, verse 22. When they rose early in the morning and the sun shone on the water, the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood. And they said, "This is blood. The kings have surely fought together and struck one another down. Now then, Moab, to the spoil! Ha ha! They've been beaten!" Now, we can understand why they might think this happened, because it happened to them just a couple of years ago. Their army, combined with Edom, had destroyed each other. And so now here they are saying, "Ah ha ha! The kings of Israel have united with Edom. It happened again. See, I told you, you can't trust an Edomite. You don't ally yourself with an Edomite, those rascals. They've killed each other off, and look, the land's just soaking up all their blood. Let's go get all the spoils of war." And so they begin to run down into the wadi to collect all the spoils. But verse 24, here's this fun contrast, all right? So they're charging down the slopes. They're in this frenzy to collect all the spoils of war, and they think they've won. But when they came to the camp of Israel, they run into the camp, and they're probably not prepared for war because they think they've already won the battle. So they don't come with their bows knocked, and they don't come with their swords drawn or their shields in their hands. They come expecting to just pick up all the goodies off the ground and strip the dead slain. But imagine the surprise on the first Moabite's face when he rounds the corner of the camp and there's Israelites sitting there. And they're all alive. And they've all got their weapons in their hands. And they're ready for a fight. And so the Moab comes pouring into the camp. But when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose and struck the Moabites till they fled before them. And they went forward, striking the Moabites as they went. And so God uses this delusion in the Moabites' mind, thinking that that all that water was blood. And they planted this thought in their heads, that the kings of Israel and the king of Judah and the king of Edom had turned on each other and slaughtered one another. And so they lose this battle. And they've got very few troops left here because this was their last resort. And so as Israel marches northward through Moab, they just go on defeating the troops of Moab. They're slaughtering them. They're killing them off. There's not much left. Verse 25, they overthrew the cities, which wouldn't have been much defense because there's nobody left to defend them. Moab has been obliterated militarily. So they overthrew the cities, and on every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. We don't know exactly how many men went on this expedition, but there probably were in the hundreds of thousands. And so, Gary, how fun would it be to plant over there at your shop if, every person in Mendota or 100,000 people walked by and threw a hand-sized rock in there? Right? Take you a little time to clear that out, wouldn't it? You'd have to have a what? A rock picker? I don't think they had them back then, though, right? Does that tote behind an oxen? I don't. Could you hook your mowers up to an oxen? Yeah? They could pull it? Guys do it? Really? That would be cool. I'd like to see that sometime. Yeah. Well, they throw a stone in all of the fields until the land was covered. As I said, this pretty much renders the land unfarmable unless a lot of work takes place. And they're cutting down all the good trees, and they're stopping up all the springs of water. So how long does it take to drill a well without a gas-powered drill? When you just have to lower a guy, we find the young, small guys like Daniel, and we hand them a shovel and a pick and say, "Get down there and start digging." Right? Now, we don't send guys like me, otherwise the well's too big. Or I get stuck. So I don't want a 6-foot-wide well, but it takes a long time to redig wells and get down there. And you're talking about a region of land where the water table is not exactly right up next to the dirt. You have to go down quite a ways. So they are ruining the land as they go through here in order to render Moab powerless. They stopped every spring of water. They felled all the good trees. That's fruit trees, by the way, the good trees. Till only its stones were left in Kir Hareseth. Kir Hareseth would be the capital city of Moab. So It's actually up here on the northern side of things. It's not on our map, but it's up here, right on the edge of the bluffs that go down towards the Dead Sea. The Crusaders built a fortress there. Very defensible position. But it's pretty much the last stronghold of Moab at this point. And so they get here to Kir Hareseth, and this is where the sieging has to take place. All of the remaining troops of Moab have gathered into the city, and it says that the slingers surrounded it and attacked it. So when we're talking about slingers, has anybody ever watched anything on YouTube or the internet that has seen a Middle Eastern person use a sling? Now, we're not talking a slingshot like you pull back and let go. You're talking one of these long lanyards with a little pouch on the end, and they swing it around in circles, and then you let go of one side of the lanyard, and it opens up and lets the rock fly. And they are amazingly accurate. And the speed they can attain on those rocks is insane, much higher than a slingshot. So you're talking about a very powerful projectile weapon. Would have been about the same thing David used when he attacked Goliath. You know, we often see pictures of little David, you know, like 6 years old with a divided stick and a slingshot. That's not a very accurate picture, but that's the idea. Is the slingers would stand there and they could sling those rocks up and hit the men standing guard on the towers and on the walls. And so this is how they're progressing the siege. Anybody that pops their heads up gets a rock put in their eye, and it's deadly stuff. So this siege is going on for a while. Verse 26, when the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him. Now, at what point in the last couple of years did the king of Moab not think the battle was going against him? He's been defeated every step of the way, and he was holding out hope that this last city could withstand the onslaught of these kings, but it's not happening. And so he finally realizes this is it. This is the this is the end of things. And so he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom. Now, why do you think he picked the king of Edom? The picture there is that if the city is surrounded, the army of Israel would have been in one position, the army of Judah in another, and the army of Edom in another spot. So they would have tried to keep to their respective positions. Why do you think he picks the king of Edom to attack and try to push his way through? So they're mad at him and he wants to go get them. Mm-hmm. Could be. Well, I'm just asking for sanctified imagination here. It doesn't tell us why, so we're not going to push too hard on it, but why else might he want to push to the king of Edom? Daniel says he's mad at him. Didn't have what? That's true. Yeah, Edom might have been short on soldiers as well because they were involved in the annihilation that took place at En-Gedi. So yeah, that's a good point. Eldon? They were the weakest ones. Huh? Brian? I'm taking you with me. Yeah. Uh-huh. It could be any of them. It doesn't tell us why he picked the king of Edom. He just did. Could be that he thought, well, you know, we were allies a few years back. Maybe if I get to him, he'll let me go through. Any one of those works. Take your pick. I won't fight with you too much over it. So when the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but they could not. He gets repulsed. He gets pushed back into the city with some heavy losses. And here he's down to his last ditch effort. Verse 27, he took his oldest son who was to reign in his place and offered him as a burnt offering on top of the wall. Why? Why would he do this? Eldon. Stupidity. That's a good explanation. Okay. Think, if you've heard this before, who is the god of Moab? Eldon? It is close to Molech. It is Chemosh. Same idea. Chemosh is going to come up later. Molech and Chemosh had a lot in common because you know what they loved? dead kids. Later in the history of Israel, this God is going to make inroads into Israel, into Jerusalem. And in the Kidron Valley, they're going to set up an idol to this God, to Chemosh. Chemosh's statue was made of iron, and it had its arms outstretched like this, and so they would start a fire at the base of it until the statue was glowing hot, and then they would throw their children into the arms of the statue and let them burn. That's how they thought to curry favor with their God. And so this last-ditch effort by the king of Moab is the last thing he can think of. And in his mind, this is the greatest devotion to his God he can possibly show by sacrificing his only son, or his oldest son. It has another little effect, and that is, if this is the son that's going to reign in his place, what did the king of Moab effectively just do? He just destroyed his kingdom. He basically signified to Israel, I'm done. I got nothing left. My heir is dead. My dynasty's over. You'll have no more trouble out of me. Now, the next couple of verses here, you can understand as we describe those things why God calls Chemosh the abomination of Moab. And he even says, this is one of these fun things in Scripture where God expresses himself to us and tries to describe himself. And he says, the abomination of Moab does things that never even entered my mind. And God says that. You say, well, how can something never enter the mind of God? He knows everything. Of course, with that idea of it never entered his intentions that we should ever do anything like that. And yet, there it is. That's how they practice their devotion to God. And Eldon said it well, because they're stupid. Stupidity. Or, to use a more biblical term, foolish. Absolutely foolish. These next couple of verses are a little difficult to understand. There came great wrath against Israel, and they withdrew from him and returned to their own land. The question is, great wrath from who? And why did it drive Israel to leave with the job undone? And the answer is, I don't know. In my studying this last couple of weeks, I haven't been able to figure this one out. Eldon. So this is God showing mercy to Moab. But why wrath against Israel then? The expression is a little difficult, even in the Hebrew. And so some of your different translations might render this differently. This is one of those few passages you run into in Scripture where you say, huh, that's interesting. I'm really not sure what this is talking about. A couple of the possibilities are that, at least one commentator I read described it this way, that God's wrath burned against Israel for driving the Moabites to that kind of desperation. I don't know if that fits the context or not. It could be that Israel was so angry at this outrage that they just decided to leave. But not all the explanations I've read didn't really give me a great sense of that's exactly what it means. And so I'll leave this to your sanctified imaginations to try to think about. And so next week, this is your homework assignment. Next week, you come in and say, Pastor, I know what it means. I have translated the original Hebrew text into English, and I think I've got it. So we'll have to leave it there, that whatever it meant, that wrath came against Israel, wrath from whom, one of the keys there is that word wrath, generally speaking, is used as wrath from God. But why the wrath comes against Israel, I'm not sure. So those are some of the things that we ponder, right? Whatever it is, it's the end of the campaign. Israel withdraws. Moab is allowed to remain for a little while longer. But they are completely stripped of their power. There's very little of them left. And so Israel returns to their own land. At this point in the narrative, the writer of Kings is going to pause with the political goings on, and he's going to focus once again on the ministry of Elisha the prophet. Because we come to chapter 4, verse 1. Well, maybe I should pause there and just say, any questions or comments on that previous section, expeditions to Moab? It's a long section, got a lot of fun detail in it. All right. Well, I must have explained it better than I thought. So we transition here to the life of Elisha. What's going to be described in this next chapter is a series of miracles, probably to show us that Elisha really has taken the mantle. We saw a couple of confirming miracles in chapter 2, right after Elijah went to heaven. And so Elisha parted the waters of the Jordan River. He cleared a spring of water that was poisonous. And he cursed the young men that were taunting him. And the bear came out of the woods and ate them. And so here we have some more miracles that not only confirm Elisha's status as the next prophet of Israel, the next great prophet of Israel, but they also show God's concern for the simple, mundane things of life. We've been really focusing throughout the books of Kings and Samuel on the major events, the political events, the wars, the kings, and things like that. But these next few miracles are all going to focus on persons, individuals. They don't have a whole lot of bearing on the great world goings on. They don't have a lot of bearing on major world events. So you wouldn't find these things on Fox or CNN in the evening, probably, because they're just very, very personal. And the first of them is verse 1 of chapter 4. Now the wife of one of the sons of the prophets. We've talked about the sons of the prophets before. Elijah started these schools where the prophets would live together in one community, and they would encourage one another, and they probably had some kind of preaching, teaching ministry going on in the nation of Israel. Remember that the point of Elijah is trying to call the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, back to covenant faithfulness. They have abandoned God's law. They are worshiping either the calf gods that Jeroboam the first set up, or they're worshiping Baal or one of the other gods of the nations that surround Israel. But what is certain is that they are not worshiping Jehovah, the God of Israel. And so when Elijah appears on the scene, his whole purpose for being there was to call Israel back to repentance. Come back and worship Jehovah God the way you're supposed to. And they have been rejecting his message and rejecting his message. Well, Elijah served in the northern kingdom for probably 10 or 12 years. And during that time, most of which, by the way, despite all the stuff that we have about Elijah, most of that time is silent. We hear nothing from him. We get a couple of major events like the contest on Mount Carmel, where fire comes down and consumes the sacrifice. We get his trip down to Sinai, which happened immediately afterwards. We get his destruction of the... What? Oh, sorry. Okay, I thought you were going to say something. So we get a few miracles going on around Elijah there, but most of the years that he is ministering are quiet. We don't hear much out of him. Same thing is going to be true of Elisha. Elisha is going to minister for much, much longer than Elijah did. And you say, what were they doing during that time? Well, one of the things they were doing were establishing these schools of the prophets. We read about one in Bethel. We read about one in Jericho. And we read about others in different places. And so they established these prophet schools where men would gather together, probably study the word, and they would pray, and God would work through these men to preach to the nation of Israel and preach repentance. And so this is who this concerns. The wife of one of the sons of the prophets cried to Elijah, "Your servant, my husband, is dead." So whatever happened, we don't know, but this poor gal's husband died. She's now a widow. "And you know that your servant feared the Lord. But the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." So here's this faithful guy, but for whatever reasons in his life, he's had to borrow money to support himself. And so when he died, he was in debt. Now, ancient Israel didn't have the legal protection that we have these days. So if your spouse dies, those debts will be taken care of out of the estate, but they don't get transferred. Well, back then they did. They especially don't get transferred to the children. Back then they did. And so if the husband dies, leaving good amounts of debt, the only solution would be for the widow to sell off everything she owns or to sell her children into servitude. They could work off the debt. The goal was that these kids would, it says slaves there, but we can read this a little bit differently. They would become household servants for the creditor. They would go and they would work off their debt. And they would get paid a regular wage. They would be, all their living expenses would be taken care of. But they would work until that debt was paid off. Or, if this was a faithful guy who followed the law, they'd work until the seventh year when all debts were supposed to be forgiven. We have to pause there for just a moment and understand that despite what we have written in the law, we understand that for most of Israel's history, they didn't follow it. They didn't do what God wrote in the law. And so when we read in the law about the sabbatical year or the year of Jubilee, you know, every seventh year all debts were released, every 50th year all land returned to its original owners, that's the way God said it should be. But Israel didn't really practice that very well. And that's one of the reasons God kicks them out of the land, is because they didn't follow the law. So here's this situation, this poor gal. Her husband's died, left her in debt, and the only thing she has to sell to take care of the debt is the workability of her kids, her sons. The creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves. Obviously, not a great scenario. You don't want to lose your two kids. Now, the other issue that's going on here is that probably these are two very young kids. Otherwise, they could go to work and earn the money. So they're very little. Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" So Elijah's switching into problem-solving mode. Well, what can we sell here? Do you have anything of value in the house? Anything you can sell off. And she says, "Nope, your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil. It's all I've got left is this one little jar of olive oil." Now, if you go to Sam's Club or Walmart, you find out olive oil is not really all that cheap, but it's not crazy expensive either. It was much harder to come by back then, and it was very valuable for its use in just about everything. They used it for perfumes. They used it for bread making. They used it for cleaning. They used it for everything. Excuse me. "I got nothing but a jar of oil." So he said, verse 3, "Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors, empty vessels and not too few." He knows what's going to happen here. "Then go in, shut the door behind you and your sons, and pour into all these vessels. And when one is full, set it aside." So here's the instructions. And you tell me if you would follow this or if you would look at the guy and say, "Are you nuts?" So you have one pint jar full of olive oil. And he says, "I want you to go to all your neighbors and borrow as many quart jars as you can possibly get a hold of." As many as you can get. Quart jars, gallon jars, pint jars, everything. Okay, big, little, don't get a few of them. So just don't think small here. Don't think like, "Oh, okay, I'll go buy one box of ball jars." Get as many as you can. And there's lots of canning kind of people around here, so it shouldn't be too hard. Eldon and Carolyn, you guys can a lot of stuff. You probably got a bunch of them at home, right? Gary, do you guys can? You used to can some stuff? Matt, Esther, do you guys can anything? Oh, Kathy, you still canning stuff? A little bit. So I got a bunch of jars over at our house. I mean, yeah, if somebody came in here and Brian says, "Look, I need some jars," we could say, "You know, we could probably get you 150, 200 jars if you need them right now." And yeah, Brian says, "Yes, do it." All right. So that's the idea. Don't get a few. Don't settle for just a couple jars. Then go into the house and start pouring. You say, "What? Now come on here. Elisha, have you never heard of the law of the conservation of matter? One quart jar of oil will not fill up 150 quart jars aside from it. It just doesn't work that way." He says, "Do it." You have to love the faithfulness of the people that listen to these prophets too. Not just the prophets for what they tell them and how they trust God, but this widow had to be somebody who trusted God and said, "Well, he's a man of God. He knows what God's intentions are in this matter, and so, yeah, I'm going to do exactly what he tells me to do." Verse 5, so she went from him and shut the door behind herself and her sons, and as she poured, they brought the vessels to her. So she's just standing here with one jar she started with, and she pours. And when that one's full, they take it out and they put the next one under it. And when that one's full, she hands it to one son, the other son hands her an empty jar. And so on and so on and so on until every jar is filled up. She finally comes to the point in verse 6, when the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, Mom, there aren't any others. We don't have any more. And it's at that point that the oil stopped flowing. So, what need do you have that God can't take care of? I love this story. Oops, I called it a story. Sorry. I love this account because it does show us that God is concerned about the individual. God is concerned about small things in our lives just as much as the big goings on in the world, and He is in control of them. Because who else could make a 1-pint jar of oil fill up 150 pints? And we're just making up some of those numbers, by the way. I have no idea how much oil it was. I imagine if she went around and gathered pints or gathered jars from her neighbors, it was a lot of them. The oil stopped flowing. She came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil, pay your debts, and what else? You and your sons live on the rest. See, here's the issue. As a widow, she would have had very little means of income. If her husband's gone, he would have been the primary worker in the family, working the field or the family business. And with him gone, she didn't have much of a means of income. And this is another reason I think the two kids are very, very young. Because she needs living expenses. And God, in His love for her and in His sovereign control, takes care not only of the debt so that she can keep her children with her, but of their living expenses until they're grown. Isn't God good? But we're not done, are we? Because there's more miracles to come. One day, now, we're not told when this is, and these miracles may have spanned Elisha's entire ministry. They probably didn't come one right after the other, right? One day, Elisha went on to Shunem. And I wanted to see if I could find Shunem here for you, so I'm going to look this up real quick. I forgot to do this earlier. I try not to do this when we have our songs up there because it tends, sometimes this locks up my computer, which is very, very bad. Okay. It says it found it, but boy, oh, there it is, right there. Okay. All right, here's Nazareth. That's a southern Nazareth, right? Here's Shunem. Here's the Valley of Jezreel. So if we zoom out, that's a lot of names. Yikes. We're in the northern kingdom of Israel. Shunem is up here. This is the Valley of Jezreel. This is the Jordan River Valley going north and south here. Shunem was up here in the hill country of Galilee. So very close to Nazareth, where Jesus would be raised later on. But there, right up there is Shunem. So obviously Elijah is traveling all over the country in his ministry. And he comes to Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived who urged him to eat some food. So whenever he passed that way, he would turn in there to eat food. Eldon, this just reminds me of Sheffy. And that cracked me up in that section where he sits down and he starts to pray and he says, Lord, we thank you for this food, even though you know it would taste better with dumplings. Right? Because the lady hadn't put dumplings in the soup. But I don't know if Elisha did that or not, but. So anytime he would pass up north there through Shunem, he had an open invitation from this woman to stop at the house and eat with her family. And this is one of the ways that the prophets would be supported. So whenever he passed that way, he would turn in there to eat food. And she said to her husband, behold, now I know that this is a holy man of God who is continually passing our way. Let us make a small room on the roof with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can go in there. they build an addition onto their house for this traveling circuit preacher, so that any time he comes, he has a private place to sleep instead of sleeping on the floor. And it sounds kind of Spartan to us. Well, he's got a table and a chair and an oil lamp, and that's it. But this was luxury conditions then. Got to understand, folks, we live in America. We're kind of upper crust of the world, right? Even the least among us has more than most of the world has. And so don't read into that and say, wow, that's all they did for this guy? This was a lot. They build an addition onto his house, fully furnished, ready for him, place to sleep, place to sit and eat, place to write, and he's even got a lamp so that he can work late hours, okay? And so anytime he's coming through, he's going to be able to go in there. This is an amazing contribution to him and what he's accomplishing. Verse 11, one day he came there, and he turned into the chamber, and he rested there. And he said to Gehazi, his servant, this is the first time we run into Gehazi. Gehazi is going to turn out to be sort of a bittersweet kind of character. He's going to serve Elisha for a long time, but he's also going to have some issues in his life that we're going to run into. And so this is the first time we meet Gehazi. But Elisha is laying there on the couch, and he's enjoying himself, and he says, boy, isn't this great? This woman has really gone out of her way to welcome me and show hospitality to me. And you know what, Gehazi? We really should do something to tell her thank you for this. And so he said, call the Shunammite. And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, say now to her, see, you have taken all this trouble for us. What is to be done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? So he's thinking through, what can I do for this gal? Maybe she needs some representation to the commander. Maybe the troops in Shunem have been bothering her or her servants, and she needs somebody to say something. Maybe she needs something said to the king. I find that one interesting because Elisha and the kings of Israel didn't often get along very well. But apparently he's got some clout. He's got some influence with them. And so he wants to return the favor that this woman has shown him. And her answer is, I dwell among my own people. What does that tell you about this woman? She doesn't want for anything. Who's her own people? Not Christians. There weren't any Christians then. What's that? Family? I think this has also got another little thing here, because here's one of the clues. Who does Elisha talk to? Yeah. Okay, where's the woman standing? According to verse 12, she's standing before him. But who does Elisha talk to? He said to him, say now to her. Why is Gehazi talking to the woman if she's standing right in front of him? I think Gehazi's translating. All right. Why would he be translating? And this woman then says, I dwell among my own people. I kind of think here that this is not an Israelitish woman. She is one of the other nations, and she doesn't speak Hebrew. And so Gehazi translates for Elisha. And yet here she is, non-Israelitish woman, but she believes in Jehovah and supports his servant. What do you want me to do? She says, I dwell amongst my own people. I don't need any help with your king. And he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, and here's another thing, because why doesn't she answer him? Because she doesn't understand what Elisha is saying at this point. So Gehazi answers for her. And he says, well, she has no son and her husband's old. And he said, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And he said, at this season, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, my Lord, O man of God, do not lie to your servant. In other words, don't get my hopes up about this. That's too big a thing to promise. You just don't get my hopes up about that. But what happened? The next year, about the same time the following year, following spring, she had a son, as Elisha had said to her. This isn't the first time an older man has borne a son. This isn't the last time that God has caused an older man to bear a son. So, what's the lesson? Watch out, fellas, right? You never know. You ready for it, Matt? Does our God care about the little details as much as he cares about the big things? You better believe it. Yes, he does. He loves you. He's watching out for those things. And so if you've got a need, you don't have to think that it's so small that God doesn't care, and have an answer for how he's going to supply it. We'll hold off there. We got a few more miracles to go through as we get through the end of the chapter.